and innovations for products like the Microsoft Xbox, digital video recorders, and digital jukeboxes. Information can be found at Seagate.com. It's Friday, May 9th, 2003, 10:04 a.m. on the central coast of California. It's time for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name's Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. This morning on Geek Speak, we discover how automated teller machines work, specifically how they authenticate your PIN and get access to your money. During the second half of the show, I will welcome you to join our conversation. The phone numbers, 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5800. I'll be giving out those numbers again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air room with me are geeks Miles Elam, Dee Dee Hubbard, John Tracy. Geeks, welcome to Geek Speak.
Morning, Lyle.
Morning, Lyle.
We have any news this morning, geeks?
Well, top of the news for me is Microsoft is having some issues with the Federal Trade Commission over Passport. Passport is their authentication system, basically keeping all of your information in one place, so you don't have to re-authenticate and refill, re-input that data over and over again on a bunch of different websites. However, there was a vulnerability in it where someone who just knew the knew a user's email address was able to access more information than they were supposed to, like their username, address, and credit card number. And
that's a bit more information than should be available to anybody.
Yeah, Microsoft has since closed the hole, but last August, Microsoft signed a consent decree promising the Federal Trade Commission that it would not make false statements about the security and privacy protections in its Passport service. And that it would improve those protections. And so this latest vulnerability is calling into question their compliance with that, whether or not they have been telling people that they are far more secure than they could guarantee, and whether or not they are liable for damages for making this available without adequate testing, this vulnerability available.
Well, they made a mistake. How can they be liable for that? I don't really get that. Because they maybe knew about it before the crack was found by other people? Or?
Well, Microsoft's in a unique position that they have, with their Passport service, they're the single hub where everyone's information will go.
They're the big brother in the situation.
Yeah, means that they have a responsibility to make sure that that information is secure. And that was one of the items that the Federal Trade Commission was concerned about, was that there was a single point of failure, and that's why they got the consent decree with Microsoft. So when you have when you're in that position, basically you need to make security audits of your software before things go live. So the fact this bug actually came about from a recent change to the software, it was not there originally.
I got it.
It wasn't
okay.
Something that wasn't seen before.
And they didn't really necessarily do the due diligence to make sure that it wouldn't happen, and so the FCC is investigating.
That's one of the possibilities. The FTC is investigating to see if that is, in fact, the case.
Thank you, Miles, for that news. Dee Dee, you have some information on the game front?
Yeah.
You know what? That microphone, I think we should just throw it away. Go ahead and swing three over there.
Hi. Yeah, for everybody who used to like Atari, Atari is back, albeit in a strange way, as Infogrames. Infogrames.
Okay.
They're the company who's brought you Unreal Tournament, Roller Coaster Tycoon, and the upcoming Enter the Matrix. And so they've rebranded themselves as Atari. So you wouldn't.
It sounds so familiar.
I wouldn't be surprised if next week, when you go to purchase the rest of your Matrix experience, Enter the Matrix, if you found an Atari sticker on it. But speaking of Enter the Matrix, which comes out the same day as the movie and the IMAX version of the movie, as Miles stated about 2 weeks ago. It's coming out on all major platforms. That's PS2, Xbox, GameCube, and PC.
Wow.
And it's not just a game based on a movie. It is a major part of what the Matrix story, because the Wachowski brothers actually wrote and produced and put together the game's story and script, and certain scenes in the game will lead you directly to scenes in the movie. And so the movie will make a whole lot more sense if you played the game.
Wow. Okay, is that a new thing in a movie release? Does anyone know? I think it is.
I could have sworn I've heard of it before, similar. But I guess
with Pac-Man
in
the
terms
movie.
Of yeah. like games being segues into the movie, not necessarily
right.
so intermingled.
Interesting. So what's going to happen is everybody's going to go see the movie. They're going to say, wow, this isn't very good. I don't understand it. They have to go buy the game. Hopefully they will. They'll play that, and then they'll love the movie.
Right.
Is that the general concept?
Kind of.
Okay.
The initial reviews I've seen of the new Matrix movie have been that it's far more action-oriented, far less philosophy.
Oh, that's good. The last one was so slow.
John, do you have any news for us today?
No.
Okay. Miles,
I had to tape my son's shirt this morning, so I didn't have time for news.
So on the news front, John's son's shirt needed tape.
He's a bee.
Miles, anything more?
There's a representative in Texas who wants to permanently ground the shuttle fleet due to the Columbia accident earlier in the year, where his premise was that one failure out of 62 flights is unacceptable. And has actually made the comment that if for 5 or 10 years we don't have human beings in space from America, so be it.
What's your thought on that, Miles?
I believe that's a bit short-sighted.
Okay. And that's it for the news this morning. ATMs are a great convenience when faced for a need for cash, and most all stores accept ATM cards as well. How can a gas station ATM card reader authenticate your PIN and approve the debit of money from your bank account and still be safe? Well, I don't know the answer to that, so I asked Michael McKay to come in and tell us all about ATM machines and the protocols that it uses. Michael McKay is Director of Software Development at IS3, Information Security Systems and Services, also known as IS Cubed. You can find information about them, www.iscubed.com. He has over 15 years of experience working with software and embedded systems in the applied cryptography arena. Michael is a member of the ANSI X9F committee, which is tasked with defining financial security standards. Michael McKay, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Thank you.
Okay. For the longest time, I imagined that an AT machine was connected to a protected network and just passed my PIN information to my bank, to the bank that I was a member of for the request and with the request of funds. But I take that it's a little more complicated than that.
Yeah, things have evolved over the years. The first ATMs came out in the late 60s, and in that situation, the ATMs actually weren't connected to the host, although maybe it might have been on a batch update, and they verified the PIN locally at the ATM.
And so every ATM machine had a copy of everybody's PIN?
Well, the way that it works is traditionally there's some kind of cryptography that's been involved, and so you'll note that I was talking about the mid-60s. The cryptography that's used nowadays is something called the Data Encryption Standard, DES, and that was actually developed in the mid-70s. So the methods of verifying the PIN have changed over the years. The original ones, there were a lot of old schemes. A lot of them were developed by the ATM manufacturers themselves. And if people are familiar with cryptography nowadays, there's kind of an ongoing thread that getting really good cryptography is hard. So some of those older schemes were not
very good.
Not very good.
Okay, so let's take the earlier examples of the ATMs when they first came out. There was a copy then of an encrypted PIN, of everybody's encrypted PIN on the ATM machines. Is that right?
Okay, well, the way that it worked is pretty much they haven't kept encrypted PINs around. What they do is they keep a hash of the PIN. And this is not just a computer science hash, this is a cryptographic hash. So that means there's a secret that's involved, and then you take in the PIN, and you
you
end up with a result. And that's a hash. In the industry, it's called a PIN verification number, or PVN. And the method of calculating that PVN has changed over the years. But that PVN would be placed on the magnetic card itself. So the machine would have the secret value that would allow it to calculate the hash. You would punch your PIN into the machine. It would calculate the hash, and then it would compare it to the value that was on the card itself.
Okay. And conceptually, you couldn't create that hash if you didn't know that secret.
That's right.
So wasn't it possible to just steal one ATM machine, figure out the hash algorithm from stealing that machine, and then be able to access any machine?
Well, there were actually a whole bunch of problems, but yeah, that was one of them.
Okay.
Another problem was that originally they only put in the PIN number as into the hash algorithm. And then it turns out that if we both just happen to have the same PIN number, I could look at the offset on your card and say, oh, you and I, we have the same offset, therefore we must have the same PINs. And if you're talking four-digit PINs, there's only 10,000 of them.
Right. So what you could easily do is steal enough of them until you found one that matched, then you'd know PIN. You could start figuring out what the algorithm was.
That's right. That. And in the back of a card, although it's kind of mysterious to the average person when they look at that, it's not secret information. Actually, they make this little magnetic spray that you can spray on the back, and you can read the back of the card and figure out what the data is, to say nothing of the fact that you can buy card readers pretty cheaply. So the information on the back of the card is considered to be public.
Okay. The information on the back of the card, on that magnetic strip, is it just stored? And when you say you can spray something on it, I'm assuming some kind of magnetic material that sticks to where the baits are and such. Does that look like a barcode?
No, it doesn't look like a barcode. It's basically digital information. They have a method of a shorter space is a zero and a longer space is a one.
Okay.
And they use an encoding scheme, so it's...
But this is all open. Like, everyone knows how to do this.
Exactly.
You can buy a scanner and get the information off the card. You can reprogram your card if you wanted to.
Yep.
So you could theoretically have a blank credit card that had your information on it and would work at ATM machines.
Yes, that's correct.
I want to do that. Keep credit cards so everybody knows you can.
Yeah, actually, I at one point I had a card writing machine, and I did my own custom graphics on that and just encoded it with that. And it's totally legal to do that.
Uh-huh. Okay. So now the... VP or PIN V, the encrypted PIN, is not on the credit card, I'm assuming.
Well, so...
Or on the card, excuse me.
All right, well, let me talk just a little bit about the progression. So the first thing that they did is they added in the account number. So each person has a unique account number. So that account number, combined with the PIN, then makes the offset unique. So I can no longer go through and if the offset's matched, it no longer means anything because you've added the account number as part of that hashing.
Right.
So
that made it safer, such that you don't have 10,000 different possibilities. You have quite a bit more,
right.
And you're not going to find a situation where two people, you'll know the PINs of two different people.
Right. Well, I mean, you still only have 10,000 results if it's a four-digit hash, but at least it no longer means if two match that they have the same PIN.
Right. Okay. So what was the problem with that solution?
Oh, well, no, that was a good solution, and so that's in use today.
Okay. So it's still on the card?
Well, okay, so now we get to the card, the verification part. In the U.S., for the most part, people no longer verify PINs at the ATM. There's a few exceptions, but it usually doesn't happen that way.
Could you conceptually do that, since the information's still on the card?
Yes, you could. And the disadvantage to that is that offset, the secret that it takes to create the offset, is a very valuable secret.
Yeah.
And so if you had that secret in all the ATMs, indeed, you could go into one ATM, break that, and at that point expose all the cards in the bank, you'd be able to create the PIN offsets, or at least verify that. So for security reasons, they tend not to want to put that secret key
in the machine. But does that mean that everybody's card does have an encryption of it? Couldn't you start collecting it and try to break it?
Well, first of all, some banks still retain offsets, and there are some reasons when it comes to verifying what they call stand-in processing that the offsets are useful. But most verification is actually done on the back end, and the so that's one aspect to what's going on. And then the other aspect is, what is it that the ATM itself is doing?
Yeah, okay.
So the ATM encrypts the PIN using a key. And at that point, the PIN, the encrypted PIN, is sent up to the host. The host then makes a decision. It says, is this a transaction that belongs to us? So if it's, for instance, a Wells Fargo customer and they're using a Wells Fargo ATM, that would be called an on-us transaction. If it is a transaction that doesn't belong to that particular ATM's banking customer, then it's a not-on-us transaction. And they will go through a switch. If you look on the back of your ATM card, you'll see a variety of little symbols. And those symbols, for instance, star or interlink, are known as switches. And the switches will connect the ATM transactions from one bank to another bank.
So that little star represents, like, if I have the little one of those little star symbols on mine, and I'm a Wells Fargo customer, that means that Wells Fargo's network supports that.
That's right. Yeah,
connection.
Wells Fargo was tied into Star.
Okay. So a lot of the banks have lots of different ways of communicating to each other, I'm assuming, because there's a lot of symbols on most of these cards.
That's right. Okay. There's actually, thanks to merger activities, there's a few less out there. But when it comes to the political structure of how ATMs work, these switches are very important. So we'll definitely talk about that a little bit more.
Well, let's take just a second. You're listening to GeekSpeak. My name's Lyle Troxell. We're talking with Michael McKay, an applied cryptographer. He works in the... he works on security standards, financial security standards, and knows a whole bunch about cryptography, and he's joining us on GeekSpeak. Okay, go on, Michael.
All right. So when last we left our encrypted PIN, it was sitting there at the host, the person who's running the ATM, and they had to decide, was this one of our PINs or was this someone else's PIN? So
now the host in some cases can be just the ATM machine itself, like if it's not connected to a bank, if it's at... No. It's whatever's connected to the ATM machine. And is that over a phone line?
Originally, they were all leased lines. And there were some security reasons why they did that. But as we all know, you can tap into these things actually fairly easily. So the security component really is designed to work on almost anything, even, including theoretically the Internet. Their latest generation of ATMs come out, can go through the Internet. The intermediate is there's a bunch of dial-up ATMs. So the ones you'll see in, say, convenience stores or at, say, a hotel, those will typically be a dial-up.
Okay. And then that connects their, what you call the host?
Yeah. So they connect to a processing host. The technical term is an acquirer.
Acquirer. Okay.
Yeah. So they have acquired the transaction.
Uh-huh. And so then the acquired has this thing that was encrypted by the ATM machine,
which is
the PIN, and then also the user information, like the account number and name and all that.
And so the acquirer is responsible for knowing what are the keys in the ATM.
Oh, because the ATM, of course, has the secret involved in just making that encryption to pass it to the...
That's right. So essentially, when the ATM encrypts the PIN, that's just the first stage of encryption, and that stage of encryption is using a secret that's shared between the ATM and the acquirer,
which is basically the owner of the ATM or that network.
Essentially, working.
And that is just to protect the information as it's passed along the phone line or whatever lease line, whatever it is.
That's
that
right.
It's connected. Okay. So now the acquirer can basically unencrypt that PIN, I'd assume.
Okay, yeah, so let's take the simple case, and let's say that this is a ATM going to an acquirer, and the customer belongs to the bank that owns the ATM.
Okay, good.
That's the simple one.
So you're a Wells Fargo or you're a Bank of America, and you go to your bank.
All right, so at that point, the bank can then look, they'll pull into the database, they'll find out what the offset for your PIN is. Now here's, you were talking about decrypting the PIN, and strictly speaking, that doesn't happen on the mainframe. They have a black box, and in the black box, it's a hardware cryptography with tamper-resistant characteristics, and they send the encrypted PIN from the ATM to the box, and they also send the reference, the PIN verification number, this hash of the PIN and the account number, into the box. The box, inside of itself, it knows the keys both to create the hash and the shared key between the ATM. So it decrypts the PIN inside the box, it calculates the offset, and then it comes back and says, yes, this was the right PIN, or no, this PIN didn't match.
Seems to me this black box would be a pretty valuable thing.
Yeah. So these boxes are, I've spent probably a good 8 or 9 years creating those kinds of boxes.
Now, where do those boxes sit? Do they sit at the... Where do they sit?
Yeah, they're part of the bank's mainframe computer rooms. Typically, these are pretty well-guarded facilities.
Okay, so, and that's one of those reasons that information is not in the ATM machine anymore, because they want it nice and private inside a secure environment, not at a convenience store.
Exactly. And in some cases, they used to use general-purpose computers, IBM hosts or what have you, to do the cryptography. But... there are a variety of issues with doing cryptography in a system, and the financial cryptography in particular, they don't want to trust
anybody.
So the problem with a lot of cryptography that's done in normal software is that you've got the equivalent of super user administrator privileges. You can monitor things, you can find out what's going on, even if the application doesn't reveal the information. I mean, an example is a Unix core dump. You can then go off and look in the memory, find what
right,
the keys are.
Right. So even though it's a little hard to hack into software that's running live, you can get memory space. You can actually do that if you have access to the machine. So the general concept is that a bank will not even entrust its employees, basically.
That's right.
Or the security of the room that it's in.
Kind of thing. And so that's probably the biggest difference between the financial security that we're talking about here and the security that people may have heard of, such as SSL or VPNs.
Right.
Is in this security, all the cryptography is done in hardware, and the cryptography is also data-oriented. If you take a VPN or SSL, it doesn't care what's flowing through the tunnel. It's a cryptographic tunnel that's been created, and it's really kind of comes as more of a layer of the network.
Right.
Financial cryptography, on the other hand, cares very much about what the data is, and certain data can have certain operations, and that's all that you allow. So it's not a generic tunnel that anything can happen with.
Okay, let me ask you this. Let's say I'm going to try to hack the system, okay? Use my hacking skills, or cracking skills, actually. I go to some convenience store that has an ATM machine that connects through maybe a phone line or a leased line situation. I tap that line, I record the transaction of the person that enters the information in. They get $40. I then take that bit of information, make my new card, go back to that machine the next day, and try to intercept the communication between the bank or the authenticator and such, and pass that same information along. Wouldn't I just be duplicating a transaction that happened the day before, and therefore it would work, or not?
Yeah, so there's at least a couple of different attacks that you're describing there. One attack is the playback, and so that's where you take a valid message and you then just repeat that valid message. And certainly that was a problem in the early days. They usually counter against that in a couple of different ways. The most important is that the transactions have unique counters on them. And so,
okay. So everyone is unique no matter what.
That's right. So another aspect is you've captured all the public information, so the card that was going across, the PIN that was encrypted, and so you're trying to take that and manipulate it in a way. So that could either be called a cut-and-splice attack, where you take... a previously known good transaction, and you try to modify it in some way that you can fake a new transaction. And so, again, the counter helps against the cut-and-splice attack, but then you add in a new element, which is called a message authentication code. People might have heard of a digital signature, which is similar in concept, but a message authentication code is where you take the message, you process it, according to a cryptographic algorithm, and you pass up that result, and if someone changes the message, it will no longer give you the same message authentication code, or MAC, as they call it, and then they'll be able to detect that some tampering has happened to the message.
It's kind of like doing a hash of the message itself.
Yeah.
With the message.
Right, a cryptographic hash of the message.
Okay, so that makes that the along this chain, there's multiple keys being stored at different locations that do different... Like between the ATM machine and the... what is it called? Acquiring host. Between those two, there's going to be at least two private keys that they both know.
Yeah. Well, right now, all financial security is symmetric-based, so it's a shared key. So that means that they're both using the same key.
Uh-huh.
And that's
and actually, SSL is kind of the opposite of that, in that you have that public and private key situation where you encrypt with one and decrypt with the other.
That's right.
And the concept being that you don't have the only secret one is the one is on one side kind of situation.
So key ownership is a very important thing, and most banks recognize that owning a key is really kind of the keys to the kingdom, and so they need to control the keys very carefully. So let me just go back to our example of our PIN, and let's say that we've you're using you have Bay Federal Credit Union, but you're using a Wells Fargo Bank ATM. So you enter in your PIN, the Wells Fargo ATM encrypts it. It goes up to the Wells Fargo acquiring host. It says, this isn't ours. We recognize, however, that this is a STAR member. So they'll go over the switch. And so what the security module on the Wells Fargo host will translate the PIN from the being encrypted under the ATM's key. It'll encrypt it with a key that's shared between Wells Fargo and the switch. Okay. In this case, STAR is the example.
And they're not going to unencode it because they don't know that information, so they just re-encrypt it?
Well, I mean, they could theoretically get the PIN in the clear, but they, well, again, it's going into this hardware security module. So the hardware security module, if it's an on-us transaction, it can verify it. And if it's a not-on-us transaction, they do a translate. Okay. So basically, they translate it from one key, the one that they share with the ATM, to a different key. This is the one that they share with the switch.
Okay. Now, and also, there the information about the user's encrypted key, which is on their credit on the card itself, is also sent along.
Yeah, that's
okay,
right.
Okay.
Okay. So then it comes up to the switch, and the switch says, "Okay, that's coming in from Wells Fargo, and this is the key that we share with Wells Fargo." They have another security module, a hardware security module, very similar to the one that Wells Fargo uses, and they do a translate from the key they share with Wells Fargo to the key that they share with Bay Federal.
And the concept of this black box is that translation is happening inside the box.
That's right.
So even though it goes in the clear, it's only inside this hardware box, which is encased and has tape on it, and you can't actually open it.
That's right.
Okay.
So neither the keys that they're sharing nor the PIN itself ever appear in the clear outside the box.
Okay.
So then from that point, it makes its way down to Bay Federal is our example here. So Bay Federal's ATM would then, host, would translate the PIN from the key that they share with the switch, and then they would verify it against the key that they have in the database.
Which is also the form that is on the actual card.
Sometimes the offset is put on the
card. Not necessarily needed, but wow, what a great process.
All right, so I'm just saying, so to just restate this, the idea then is that different people own different parts of the transaction, but throughout, everything from the ATM where you enter your PIN, after that, it's no longer appears in the clear anywhere in the whole process.
And the idea behind that, of course, is that anybody that's connected to that STAR network is in a dangerous situation if one of those other customers, other peripheral that's connected to the network, is not doing a good model.
That's a very good point. We'll
it's a political
on that
thing
in a moment.
Okay, great. You're listening to GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air room with me are geeks Dee Dee, Miles, and John. We are talking, mostly I've been talking, with applied cryptographer Michael McKay about ATM authentication and encryption. We now invite your questions and comments about technology. You're welcome to call in about ATMs, cryptography, or anything about the computer problems. The phone numbers are 476-2800. Or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. You can also use the internet, geeks@geekspeak.org. Just open your mail client, send us an email. This program is supported by a grant from Cruise.io, providing internet service including DSL and spam filters for home and office throughout Santa Cruz County. Information about Cruise.io membership is available online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. My name is Lyle Troxell. You are listening to Geek Speak.
This is John Tracy bringing you today's Geek Bit. Computer memory. What exactly is computer memory? Well, there are two kinds: RAM, where things happen, and storage. Fixed media, such as a hard drive, a CD-ROM, or floppy disk, where things are kept in a more permanent fashion. RAM is where things happen because it's fast. When you double-click an icon, like an application, your computer loads the program from the hard drive into RAM. Once it's there, the computer can access the data much faster. However, RAM needs a constant supply of electricity to keep the information stored there. As soon as you turn off the machine, the information in RAM, it's lost. That's where fixed media, like a hard drive, comes in. It's much slower than RAM. For example, if it took 3 minutes to retrieve a piece of data from the hard drive, it would take only 2 seconds to retrieve it from RAM. However, it writes the information using a more permanent method. When the electricity is turned off, the information is still there. So what about virtual memory? Virtual memory is a portion of the hard drive pretending it's RAM. The computer loads part of the application onto a specific place on the hard drive where it can retrieve instructions from it as though it were RAM. It takes much longer, of course, but it allows a program to run that would not normally have been able to. It's a holdover from the days when RAM was very expensive and not as available as it is now. Today, all modern operating systems have some form of virtual memory so the computer can free up space and RAM as it's needed. So, when a program, or your child, asks you for more memory, they usually mean RAM. When you run out of space to store stuff, you need a larger storage device, like a hard drive. This has been John Tracy with your Geek Bit. Join us for Geek Speak, Fridays, 9 to 10 a.m. here on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP.
And Geek Speak, of course, is currently at 10 o'clock on Friday mornings on KUSP. You are listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. We are talking about the technology behind automated teller machines and encrypted communication for financial transactions. In the air room with me are geeks John Tracy, Miles Elin, Dee Dee Hubbard, and cryptography expert Michael McKay. We await your questions and comments. The numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. The email address for the geeks, geeks@geekspeak.org. Michael, how do ATMs get these secret keys to communicate with their authenticating body?
Well, that's something that's in the process of changing. The originally, all the ATMs that were owned by a bank, for instance, or an institution, would have the same key in them. So that went back to one of our earlier comments that if you broke into the one ATM, you could then compromise all the ATMs that are owned by that particular bank. A couple of years ago, I think the actual standard was mandated by last year. They dictated that all ATMs have to have unique keys. And right now, it's two guys in a van. What happens is they use split knowledge procedures. So each person can't know an entire key. So they have to send two people out, each of whom have half the key.
And speak different languages so they can't speak? I mean, couldn't they theoretically share that information with each other?
Yes, they could theoretically share that
information. But they don't. These are trusted individuals.
In theory, yes.
Okay.
And so the two guys get in a van, they punch a button on the back of the ATM, and they put that key in. So one guy puts in one half of the key, and the other one puts in the other half.
And they have whole procedures so that the other one leaves the room and makes sure that
that
no one can look, and you look for video cameras to make sure no one sees them entering it, that kind of thing.
That sounds like James Bond. Okay, on the count of three.
It does. Yeah.
And so that's the way that they have to do that. And so needless to say, this is rather expensive. It costs up to several hundred dollars to put a key into the ATM. Luckily, they only have to do that when they're installing the ATM or if maybe something breaks on the ATM. It's a lot more complicated now than it used to be because all the guys always had the same key.
How do they get these multiple? Is there some van with like 30 envelopes for each? I mean,
So what happens now is that they have secure envelopes. These kind of look, you may have seen them, for instance, when you get a new card and the PIN comes in the mail in a security envelope. So they use envelopes kind of similar to that, and they've got unique ones for each ATM.
But are those all stored in the van?
They'll load up the ones that they expect to use in the van.
Wow. So conceptually, that's kind of a security breach, because you could theoretically, like if the van got in an accident or something, and then all of a sudden someone has a box full of cards, you could theoretically...
Yeah.
That would be very difficult.
Yeah, so it's a costly, time-consuming process. And unfortunately, one of the realities is that a lot of banks don't observe all these procedures quite as well as they should.
Right.
And so that's a constant, ongoing battle.
But the standard of having multiple, I mean, having a new key, a different key pair for every ATM machine seems like a good one, because what happens if you had 300 ATM machines easily, and one of them was taken, and then the keys were all the same in all of them? Theoretically, your entire fleet has to be changed, right?
That's right.
So that's a bad model.
Yeah, I think the largest processor has something on the order of 35,000 ATMs. So
and there now, I'm assuming, have different keys for each one.
Yes,
there's got to be a database then of these keys, and therefore, that's a security breach, because you could have a administrator that has that access to that database would know all the keys to all the ATM machines, right?
So again, they store them in separate envelopes, and each envelope may have its own safe, and each person has access to that particular safe. So
wow.
there's a
30,000 safes.
Right. One of the things that I've been doing a lot in the last several years is actually trying to automate that process of what it takes to get the keys out to the individual ATMs. But you could see that there's quite a bit of cost and hassle and security savings that can happen if you can automate that somehow. And we're just starting to see that occur in the industry. Within the last 6 months or so, ATM manufacturers have started coming out with some public key devices as part of their ATM that will help them avoid the two guys in the van scenario.
All right, we got some calls. Jane from Aptos, the Mac question. Jane, please, welcome.
Yes, hi. I have actually two questions, but my first and foremost is about a laptop, G4, premium.
Okay.
Since I first got it, I have not been able to access the help file via the help center.
Okay, so it's a Mac OS 10 or later laptop, and when you open up help, you always get errors?
No, when I open up the help, let's say I'm using whatever application, FileMaker.
Okay, and you save help?
So I go to the help file because I want information about how to do something, and then the help center opens, and I click on the link to the help center, and the iBeam cursor does not change to a hand until I actually click on the link. And then once I click on the link, it changes color but does not access the file.
You know, the help center for Mac OS X, I have found, has been so slow. Now, I haven't seen a situation like this. Normally, if I copied a program over and didn't install it correctly and the help files aren't there, you get errors sometime in that regard. But I haven't seen a situation where the actual link doesn't work. Dee Dee or John, you're both the Mac experts. Can you help us out on this one? You're both looking no.
Yeah, I'm not really familiar with the help, actually.
I've used it in the past, and I found that it's very crashy.
The help application, that's right.
It often, when you actually use it, it will do the spinning beach ball of death.
Yeah.
And then crash.
Jane.
I find that it's just easier to look things up on the manufacturer's
Google.
Website.
Or on the manufacturer's. Yeah. Jane, what I do traditionally when I'm trying to find some help is I'll open up the help support system on the application. It will be slow and hard to search, and then I'll get frustrated and open up a browser while it's kind of doing things and try to find the information online, mostly Google. Now, FileMaker, you mentioned. FileMaker help, in my opinion, is pretty bad at their site. But there's a lot of developers in the FileMaker environment. So getting help doing a Google search for your actual problem, let's say you want a certain function, like the left function, find out exactly how it works, you could easily look up FileMaker, your version number, and then the left, with uppercase L. Well, it wouldn't really matter. And you'll probably get a lot of help on that function on the Internet.
I need to interject that you are making the assumption that everyone has access to the Internet.
I am making that assumption.
And the help file, regardless of whether you're connected to the Internet or not, should work.
Yes, I agree they should. But the application is pretty buggy. It's one of those flaws at this point for
Apple. Never, in OS 9, any version, I've never had this problem. OS 10.
What version of 10 are you running?
I started with Jaguar, and I'm now in 10.2.5, and I still have the problem. I was on the phone with Apple for hours, and what they had me do with my computer, I'm at the point now where hardly anything works. Most of the applications will crash now after their information, and I'm having to just erase my hard drive and
start over.
Start all over.
How frustrating.
Frustrating?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Your understatement award is waiting for you in the lobby.
Here's another thought. The help files for, now I'm guessing here, Dee Dee, maybe you'll know this, the help files for OS X's help environment are actually HTML documents. Is that
yes,
right?
Yes, they are.
So theoretically, you could find the help files through your web browser. They're on your computer.
Actually, if you're looking for specific help with FileMaker, it does have HTML documentation in the FileMaker application folder,
yeah,
which you could navigate to.
Help file. It doesn't matter what. It's even Apple's own help
right.
file.
So I mean, the application is really dying for you. It's not functioning.
It doesn't.
Right. And what we're saying is that you can. This is a really big problem, and it's something that Apple should fix. Hopefully they will. I see problems in the application, too. Not to the extent that you do, but I think that people have problems with this application in general. And one way to go about it is don't use the help application, but open those same help files through your web browser. The problem is finding them. And what we're suggesting that is in FileMaker, they are in the FileMaker application directory under some documentation folder, and you can open up the files directly, and they should open up in your web browser. So
okay.
that's our only suggestion at this point.
Usually those help files exist in on your hard drive at the root level, which is when you first open up your hard drive, inside
right.
the library.
Inside the library.
Inside documentation. That's where most of the help files
are. Yeah, so go to your root, look at library, documentation, and then you might have to take the file that's an HTML document or HTML document and drop it on top of a browser icon
fine.
It to open. So that's one possibility. I know it's really frustrating. I wish that the application worked better.
Right. Okay, my second question is, why is it that if I boot into OS 9.2, or classic mode, why does my hard drive the active window show that my hard drive has less space than it does when I'm in OS 10?
Okay, so if you look through OS 9, are you swiping specifically in classic or when you reboot into OS 9?
I reboot into OS 9.
Okay, why does your hard drive show that it has less space than in the OS 10 situation?
Correct.
Dee Dee, got a guess on this one? I got one. John? Okay, my guess is that, I lost it.
Well, thinking that perhaps something in my home directory was larger, but I knew off the bat, I mean, that was kind of one of my thoughts, was that my home directory was larger than the root directory, but it couldn't be. So, and it was always, my applications folder in the home directory was larger than the applications in the root directory. But
that's... seems very strange.
It's not. In fact, I purposely put most all of my files and applications in the root directory, so I have very little stored in the home directory. And I could have, say, a gigabyte of space when I'm booted into OS 10. If I boot into OS 9, it'll show that I only have maybe a couple hundred megabytes.
I'm not sure why that's happening. We're questioning here, but if we figure it out, we can post it on the website, geekspeak.org. Thank you, Jane, for your call.
Sure.
And we're going to jump right back into a call from Mike. Mike, human factors and security, please explain.
Yeah, actually, hey, how you guys doing? You don't hear many programs about authentication on the radio. That's for sure. Actually, what I was talking about is human factors, card surfing, high-powered shoulder surfing, and how unsafe the first part of the transaction is, which is the customer putting the card into the ATM. A fake membrane keyboard, a simple magnetic recording device directly on top of an ATM, you can gain, the initial trust of the system by its weakest link, the end user. And it's still the most limiting factor. I'm in favor of something simple like thumb biometric authentication to make the initial part of the transaction secure. That's where it's weakest.
Yeah, and so what you're saying is that a thin keyboard means you take the keyboard of the ATM, you take another keyboard, and you slap it on top. You have a little microprocessor in there with a battery.
Someone bada bing, bada bang.
What's that?
You're right. We did the first one with an HP Jordana just as an experiment. Wrote a screenplay about it.
Yeah, so the general concept is you put a new keyboard on top of the ATM keyboard. Someone goes and accesses it. When they're pushing it, it actually is pushing the ATM keyboard as well, but also recording everything that happens. And then a magnetic reader along the card swiper also gets the card information. So basically, you've duplicated the card information without the user ever knowing about it. And then you can collect that for a couple days at an ATM machine. ATM machines are accessible, really easy to put this stuff on. And then at the end of the week...
You hit the nail on the head. You have a very good understanding of the subject.
Right, so that is a problem. The other thing you could of course do is just record what keys are being struck with a camera over the person's shoulder.
High powered or aided.
Right.
Vision.
So yes, those are all pretty bad situations, and of course biometrics at the ATM machine would be make it a little bit better.
I actually have a couple patents at Intel on biometric authentication, so it's easy to do it by more than one factor: a fingerprint and resistivity.
Right.
Receptors cost all about $10 per machine. And of course, the data structures that would be required, you know, all the way down the system for authenticating the fingerprint, too, as well.
Yeah. Michael, do you have a
question? Yeah. Well, actually, I think those are all good points. And there's one thing that you learn, particularly in the security industry, and that is that people will attack the weakest link. If the cryptography is really strong, then they'll go and try to observe the PIN as it's being punched in. So.
The low-lying fruit, so to speak. At the moment, I'm net stumbling through a neighborhood. If you guys know what that is.
Sure.
Yeah. So just to bring up the two points, there is one thing that you can do to help yourself as an average person who uses the ATM or the point-of-sale terminals at a supermarket, and that is, don't be ashamed. You know, put your hand over the other hand that's typing it in, or put your body in the way so nobody can look. So you can take some proactive steps to stop the shoulder surfing.
Look for any kind of alteration on the machine, anything that even looks slightly out of the normal.
Right.
A wire on the outside, a piece of tape on the outside. If it looks funny, it could be funny.
Yeah, and so that's a good point. I went into a local shoe store, and... They had a point-of-sale terminal there, and it had some safety tape on it, and the screen was cracked, and the safety tape, tamper-resistant tape, was off, and they were asking me to punch my PIN into this terminal. And I was looking at them, and I was going, you know, you really ought to call in. I'm not going to use that terminal.
Yeah, unless the consumer starts to be proactive about this sort of thing, it will happen.
Yeah.
It's very clear. It's public knowledge.
So the other thing is, I did want to mention that there are a number of standards on that, and I think things really have been improving. You'll notice, for instance, the newest Wells Fargo just rolled their ATMs to the latest generation of NCRs, and you'll notice that the keys they've got a very tactile feel to them, so it'd be very difficult to cover them up without noticing that something was going on strange. And there's also some internal security changes that they've done, which I don't know if we have time to get into, but...
Mike, thank you very much for your call.
Hey, it was a lot of fun, and I recommend you guys go to routergod.com. I'm MW Boy there, and fun, interesting articles about network Cisco router security, all written from movie star perspective.
Okay, well, thank you, Mike, for the call.
Have fun.
Mike from Santa Cruz. Now, Michael McKay, point of sale, the one you were talking about at a shoe store, you were using a point of sale machine. That's the little machines people hand you and you're supposed to enter the PIN in. And are those secure?
Well, they are not as secure as an ATM, just like an ATM isn't as secure as those the black boxes on the host, the acquiring host. Almost by a cost basis. The ATMs cost anywhere from $5,000 to $13,000. The black boxes I was talking about run $20,000 to $50,000. The point of sale terminals run about $400 to $500.
So therefore they're not secure?
They're not as secure. So actually there's an interesting cryptographic trick that's done on the point of sale terminals, and that's something they call it perfect forward security.
Perfect.
Ignore the term perfect because, you know, that kind of leaps out. But this goes back to one of the things we were talking about. Let's say that I've got one of these cheap, inexpensive point-of-sale terminals, and I tape all the transactions that are being done on this terminal. So I get 4 weeks worth of transactions that go through this this point of sale terminal. Now I go off and I break into it, and I've said that it's easier to break into these point of sale terminals because they cost less. And I get the key, the secrets, all the secrets out of this point of sale terminal. The concept of perfect forward security, or PFS, is that all that recording won't do me any good. So the key changes with every transaction, and it changes in such a way that the terminal no longer knows the secrets of that old transaction.
Kind of like alarm systems in cars, where every time you push it, it's a new key gen.
Yeah, similar in concept to that.
Now, isn't it possible, though, just to replace the point-of-sale machine at at a store with something that's recording the PIN and the user's information? I mean,
There's one level of protection, which is if you did a PIN transaction and it actually participates on the network, you actually get charged for that point of sale and for that transaction. There's actually some pretty good assurance then that that was a real point of sale terminal. However, what's to keep a mom and pop merchant from installing some kind of PIN collecting device, pretending to you that the transaction went through, and then just harvest, they've got all the information they need.
And then going to Tahiti.
Yeah, going to Tahiti and using that. So actually that's another little thing you can do for yourself, is keep track of all the transactions. And of course, if you've got a charge on your bill that you didn't participate in, that, you know, that's a dangerous part. But it's just as dangerous to have no charge for a transaction you did do. So there's a couple of ways that eventually we'll get around that. Biometrics is a lot more complicated than our caller indicated.
Why is that?
Well, there's issues of playback. Once you have my thumbprint, for instance, how can you keep, anybody can use my thumbprint.
But isn't it conceivable that the thumbprint face is actually a black box, so that by the time you get the outside, you actually have encryption of the
Yeah, but thumbprint? We just talked about not trusting the black box.
Right, okay.
Okay. So, I mean, you know, there's techniques and schemes you can do to help things out, and it is a help, but it's not just a magic wand. You can say, okay, everyone, we're going to take biometrics, and that'll solve all our problems.
Wouldn't it be better if, like, every once in a while you got an encrypted package from the bank, which was the next 50 PIN numbers you can use, and you have to change it every time? Wouldn't that be best?
Well, then people wouldn't remember them. They'd have to write them down. What I do actually recommend is that you change your PIN on a regular basis. And most institutions, if you go up to the new accounts clerk, they'll have the ability to change your PIN.
Does she type it in or he type it in?
No. Most institutions, you actually will type it into a secure terminal, much like a point-of-sale terminal, and they'll change it right there on the spot.
And you're actually doing the changing?
Right. So about every 6 months to a year, it's a good idea.
Okay. How do these standards of how this whole standard process works? I mean, who defines those standards?
Well, as you know, I serve on the ANSI committee, and in some senses, it's almost a bit academic. We can come up with all the standards we want, but people aren't going to apply them unless it makes sense to them. And some banks are very proactive out there. They'll go out of their way to do good security. There are other banks that they won't do anything unless they have a club over their head. And in this case, the club that is over most banks' head is participating on the switches, the networks. So Star, MasterCard, Visa. So Star and MasterCard. Our Star and Interlink are the switches who do debit transactions. And then Visa and MasterCard come into the picture also. They do some switching. They also have requirements for people who want to use their cards. So they're usually the people who actually dictate the standards. So I'd mentioned that all the ATMs had to have unique keys. Visa was the first one to come out with that standard a while back. And the club that is over the bank's head is... if you want to have interlinked transactions, or if you want to have Visa card or MasterCard transactions, you have to perform these or else you're going to be cut off. And sometimes they don't cut them off. They just say, okay, your transaction price will go up. You know, you're taking on extra fraud, so instead of costing you 5 cents a transaction, it'll cost you 20 cents a transaction.
Okay. What about this recent, maybe you know a little bit about this recent court case where the credit card companies were doing something that was wrong? Can you enlighten us a little bit on that?
There has been some general antitrust concerns about MasterCard and Visa. Interestingly enough, both MasterCard and Visa are theoretically nonprofit organizations that are run by member banks. So each bank can join, and when they join, they become a part of this nonprofit group. And for a while, it was separate. You could be one or the other. Now they can join both of them, or American Express. So there have been some court cases. There's been a couple of them. One of them was that Visa and MasterCard were somehow working together to exclude other credit cards like American Express or Discover. There was another one where they have a concept. I loosely call all these transactions debit transactions, but one meaning of debit transaction is a card that can be either an ATM card or a credit card. And this is a fairly new concept. They came up with it about 5 years ago, and both Visa and MasterCard pushed this concept onto the merchants pretty heavily.
They basically forced them to do it if they wanted to take the cards at all.
That's right. They said, if you want to have MasterCard credit transactions, you also have to do MasterCard
and hence
debit
transactions. Hence the illegality. We're actually running out of time, so I'm going to cut you off there. This program is supported by a grant from Seagate Technology. Seagate is a worldwide supplier of disk drives for PCs and servers and innovations for products like the Microsoft Xbox, digital video recorders, and digital jukeboxes. Information is at Seagate.com. This is GeekSpeak. I'm Lyle Troxell. Our guest this morning, Michael McKay, is the Director of Software Development at Information Security Systems and Services. You can find out more information about IS-Cubed at www.iscubed.com. Michael has 15 years of experience in the applied cryptography arena and is a member of the ANSI X9F committee, which is tasked with defining financial security standards. On his spare time, Michael is a consumer rights advocate. This was his third appearance on GeekSpeak. Mike McKay, thank you for joining us today on GeekSpeak.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
This morning, the geeks were Dede Hubbard, Miles Elam, and John Tracy. Our producer is Maggie Cleveland. Answering the phones was Maggie as well. Thank you for all your participation on GeekSpeak. To those of you that called, thank you very much for making GeekSpeak what it is. Without your input, it would just be us geeks geeking out. And who wants to listen to that? This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, Santa Cruz, KBDH, San Ardo, and on the web at kusp.org. I'm Lyle Troxell. This is GeekSpeak. Coming up next is Fine Print.